and welcome to Connected Roots, Educational Insights for a Better World. This podcast is a collective effort brought to you by the Humane Education Coalition. Connected Roots features inspiring interviews and stories from experts in the field of humane education. I'm your host, Megan Moon, president and founder of the Coalition. We are a global alliance for collective impact. We collaborate with partners in the human rights, environmental ethics, and animal protection sectors to achieve common goals and support their work. You can learn more at hecoalition.org. On today's episode, I'm thrilled to welcome a special guest, Dr. Mark Beckoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mark is a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and former Guggenheim Fellow. He has written or edited more than 30 books, the latest being The Animal's Agenda with Jessica Pierce, Canine Confidential, Why Dogs Do What They Do, and the forthcoming book, Unleashing Your Dog, A Field Guide to Giving Your Canine Companion the Best Life Possible, also with Jessica Pierce. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Connected Roots.
It's my pleasure to be here, Megan. I love the work that your coalition is doing, so I'm thrilled to be part of it.
Well, thank you, Mark, and we're grateful for your support and involvement. So tell me, how did you come to pursue this career in animal protection and teaching? What brought you to feeling so strongly and so compassionate about animals?
Well, I always say, I think it was in my genes, G-E-N-E-S, and I just grew up in a really friendly, peaceful, compassionate household, and my mom was a very compassionate, empathic woman, and, very pacifistic, so we were just really against all sorts of violence, and I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, or I guess I haven't grown up yet, but I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and I used to say hello to all the animals on the concrete sidewalks, the squirrels and the ants and the birds and the dogs and the cats. And when I was young, everybody seemed to have that requisite goldfish in a bowl. And I didn't like it, but I didn't know how to say I didn't like it other than, you know, asking the goldfish whether he or she was happy. So I used to talk to the goldfish. And I think one of the things which was nice was, I think maybe in retrospect, my parents thought I was nuts, but they never told me they thought I was nuts. And they never stopped me from expressing my feelings, because I could feel the pain and suffering, you know, as it turns out, in all these animals. So it started really early in life. And my parents told me that I was minding animals, and that became a title for a book I published in 2002, meaning that I minded them by attributing, you know, minds and active brains and feelings to them. And I minded them in terms of, caring for them and yelling at people when they would, you know, yell at their dog or, you know, just make some disparaging comment about non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. Developing that level of compassion at such a young age is remarkable. So tell me about your most recent books on canine behavior and giving our canine companions the best life possible. What have you learned about dogs through your research that would be helpful for our listeners? Anything that would help them have a better relationship with their dogs?
Yeah, I mean, It seems like 99% of my waking hours, I'm either riding my bike or reading or writing about dogs. And so, but I'm really passionate about dogs. I published a book last year called Canine Confidential, Why Dogs Do What They Do. And I mean, there's a lot of major messages in there, I think, but I bring a pretty unique perspective to the behavior of domestic dogs because I'm a field biologist. I did 9 years of field work on coyotes in Jackson Hole. I've watched wolves. I studied penguins in Antarctica and birds in the foothills of Boulder. So I bring what we call like an ethological view to the study of animals and to the study of domestic dogs, which basically means I'm interested in why different behavior patterns have evolved. why did they appear sometime in the evolution of these animals, and why did they evolve, and why are they retained in the repertoire of the animals? So a couple of messages is dogs are sentient beings who care about what happens to them and their families and their friends. They're smart. They're very clever. We have a commitment, you know, we call it the cradle to grave commitment. And that means from the day somebody decides to take a dog into their homes and into their hearts, they're responsible until that animal takes their last breath. And a lot of people don't realize that adding a dog to your home is a major, major thing. And people need to do their homework before they decide to bring a dog home, say. And another message is there's know the dog, that there's an amazing amount of variation within within the species of dog, if you will. And there's amazing amount of personality variation and behavioral variation, even in siblings and litter mates. So what I try to do in Canine Confidential is sort of wrap it up into one package, saying you're dealing with a sentient, caring being who expects that you're going to give them the very best life possible, which means that it's a trade-off. But we have to be sure that they don't lose when we're in these negotiations. So their walks are for them. If they need vet care, you need to give them the best vet care possible. You need to give them exercise. You need to allow them to socialize with friends, dogs, and humans. And related to, you know, giving them the best life possible, I have a book that's probably coming out in a couple of weeks with my friend Jessica Pierce. And there we stress how important it is to allow dogs to exercise their senses. So we describe in that book how humans who choose to live with dogs can give dogs the best life possible in addition to physical exercise by letting them exercise all their senses. And just a couple of weeks ago, there was a paper published that showed that allowing dogs to sniff improves their disposition and makes them happier and more optimistic. So there it is. But the bottom line is, you have a dog in your life or another companion animal, you are their lifeline, and you need to give them everything they need to have the best life possible.
Wow. Thank you, Mark. This is so helpful. This is the first I've heard about that research, and it's just fascinating. I remember when I read the section on companion animals in the Animals Agenda, your book, I was blown away because I hadn't really considered the fact that, you know, I was giving this great home to my dog and I love and cherish her as a family member, but we control when she eats. We control when she has access to the outdoors or when she can go to the bathroom. We essentially control her entire life. And as a result, her freedoms have been limited. And I think about that section of the book all the time now in my relationship with her and how we have a responsibility to give her the freedom she deserves as a living being. You know, her life has so much value independent of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this new book is called, Unleashing Your Dog, you know, giving your canine companion the best life possible. And that's exactly how we begin, is that, and it's not a negative thing, but, you know, the description of the book and the beginning of the book really deals with dogs as captive animals. They are captive. And like you said, we decide when they eat, what they eat, with whom they eat, when they poop or pee or go outside, when they play, with whom they play, where they sleep, whether they actually get the vet care that they need, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so taking that perspective really just, you know, in a sense, drives home the point that we are responsible for the very lives of these animals. I like to say we're their oxygen, and they depend on us, and they depend on our goodwill. So, thanks for that. I mean, when Jessica and I wrote The Animal's Agenda, and actually Jessica and I wrote this Unleashing Your Dog, you know, we really spent a lot of time, you know, realizing that most people, surely, when they decide to take a dog or other companion animal home, have the best intentions possible, but a lot of them take animals home about whom they know nothing. And there was just a recent study of people who take reptiles home, and reptiles are really hard to keep as companion animals, but most of the people who take them home, or a large percentage, know nothing about the behavior of these animals, say, you know, if they were living in their natural habitat. So,
right. Mark, you've written so many incredible books. The Emotional Lives of Animals, Animals Matter, your newest books on dog behavior, which we've talked about, and my personal favorite, The Animal's Agenda. So many of these books I've come to rely on for guidance in my own work in animal protection over the years. Which book has been your favorite one to write? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I ponder that question a lot. I wrote a book with Jane Goodall called The Ten Trusts. And that was great. That was just really wonderful to write. I mean, she's a good friend and, you know, we talk a lot. And at the time we were talking on the phone as we were writing it. So there was a lot of personal contact and we were faxing one another. And Jane had just begun using email, believe it or not. And so we were exchanging faxes, like if she were home in England or in Europe, you know, sometimes at 4 a.m, because I get up early, I'd have something from her that almost corresponded identically to what I left the night before without us talking. So it was really fun because we were, you know, we were really clearly on the same page. And it was just great because I learned a lot from her as we were writing just about how, you know, she's just an amazing woman, an icon, how she thinks about things. And she learned a lot from me and we really shared these experiences. So, you know, having said that, Jessica and I have published 3 books and we are now writing another one for Princeton University on what the world will be like for dogs as humans disappear or when they disappear. So I don't want to put Jessica aside because she's a wonderful woman too. But I really like writing all my books. I guess the bottom line is I really enjoy reading and learning and writing. So as far as the books that I've written on my own, I like them all.
That's fair.
Well, I mean, one of the most personal books I wrote is called Rewilding Our Hearts. And when I say personal, because it's really talking about the rewilding and reconnecting with nature from a personal and a spiritual perspective. So I shared a lot of my stories in that just because that's how I've always connected with animals. So, yeah, I appreciate your question and I hope I answered it to some extent.
Absolutely. Yeah, you did. So I was hoping today you could share a little bit about the concept of compassionate conservation. Could you tell our listeners maybe what this term means and how they can apply the concept in their own lives or their own work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So compassionate conservation has been a long time coming. And the two basic foundational principles, if you will, are first, do no harm, and the life of every individual matters. And for me, what that really means is that we need to consider the lives of every single individual as being important. And in The Animal's Agenda, Jessica and I developed the concept of the science of animal well-being in contrast to the science of animal welfare, because the science of animal welfare really lets down billions of animals, because what the science of animal welfare says is we need to give animals the best lives we can. We need to do all we can for them. But in the end, it's okay to use them. And it's usually using them in the name of humans. Very little research that's been done on animals themselves really goes back to the animals. So the science of animal well-being is kind of an extension of compassionate conservation, because the life of every individual matters. And the reason the life of every individual matters is because they have inherent or intrinsic value. Their value isn't determined in what we call an instrumental way by what they can do for us. Their value is measured in a very simple way, and that is they are alive. From a practical point of view, compassionate conservation means no more killing. I mean, for me, killing is off the table. You know, people think it's just kind of like, you know, this sort of bells and whistles or, you know, type of approach, and, you know, that crystals are involved because I live in Boulder, Colorado, and stuff like that. But no, it's not. It really is a serious move to say no more killing. It's too easy to kill, because welfarists can always say, well, the costs and the benefits, you know, need to be evaluated. And if the benefits outweigh the costs, it's okay to kill or harm these non-human animals. And I'm saying that the time has come, get killing off the table. And I know that there are problems out there, and I know there are, quote, problem animals. But the people working in this area, by and large, are smart enough to develop humane and non-lethal methods. So I also tie compassionate conservation into the humane education movement, in the sense that I get emails all the time from people saying, oh, I want to do field work on a particular animal, and I want to, you know, study a certain question, but the way it's been done in the past involved, you know, invariably harming and sometimes killing other animals. And I'm going, wow, you know, here are some other alternatives, or in conjunction with the either, you know, they're usually students, but they can be, you know, research professors, develop non-lethal and more humane methods to study a particular question at hand. And so that's it in a nutshell. We get input from biologists, psychologists, sociologists, lawyers, political scientists, artists. And that's what I love about compassionate conservation too, that it's multidisciplinary, and we can all learn from one another.
Yes, I love the opportunities compassionate conservation offers for collaboration and learning from each other. So let's switch gears here for a minute and talk about the Jane Goodall Institute's Roots and Shoots program. I know you are an ambassador for the program, and many of us in humane education are familiar with the Roots and Shoots program. What is your role there as an ambassador? What do you do?
Well, to be honest with you, Jane named me an ambassador because I was traveling a lot all over the world, and I was doing Roots and Shoots events all over the world, and did some with Jane in different countries. And, you know, so as an ambassador, really, it's just to spread the good word, because, you know, in some countries there's Roots and Shoots groups in, I don't know, maybe 120 different countries now. But it was more to just spread the good word, because I would sometimes do Roots and Shoots events with people who weren't part of the organization, hoping that they would join. So it wasn't like, you know, they had to be members in order for me or someone else to do a program. So that was my role. And it's also just a project in humane education, and, you know, for animals, people, and the environment, which conveniently spells ape, and chimpanzees are great apes, so I like that. And I've been teaching a course at the Boulder County Jail for 17 years now that focuses on animal behavior and compassionate conservation. And you know, talking to the guys I teach, I only teach men in the transitions program, talking to them about the importance of compassion and empathy and respect for other beings. And over the years, I've had a lot of guys in my class just tell me how talking about topics like that and talking about compassion and conservation has softened them. It's made them realize that, and a lot, most of them know this, that they're not going to get, they're not going to go on in life by repeating the things they've done, you know, that result in them being incarcerated. So the program is really very broad. There was a group in Jordan working on water issues because, you know, that's a very strong environmental concern there. So what I love about Roots and Shoots is it fits itself to the local conditions or local situation. And it also stresses act locally, think globally. Get people off their whatevers to do something. Well, you know, my take is I realize that probably the vast majority of people in the world are just trying to live from day to day. So I always just say, if you can do something, you must do something. And that really, you know, some people think it's a burden, but I really mean it to say that there's so many people in need. There's so many non-human animals in need. It's essential to take care of them. And that links to what's called the One Health view, which really basically says that we all need to be concerned with the well-being of non-humans and humans. That in today's complicated world, challenging world, we need to pay attention to all the stakeholders, non-human and human.
Thank you for mentioning One Health, Mark. I'm a little familiar with the One Health approach from our mutual colleague, Dr. Sarah Bexell's work at the University of Denver's Institute for Human-Animal Connection. As a coalition board member, Sarah has helped introduce the One Health approach and how it relates to humane education, which is great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Sarah is a leader in that field. And the courses at the Institute for Human-Animal Connection at the University of Denver they're just amazing. I mean, the whole program is amazing. But I realized personally, and, you know, talking to people like Sarah and others, you get much more traction when you're dealing with the well-being of non-humans, when you, you know, just admit to the fact that there's humans involved too. Because, you know, people often say, oh God, there's so many humans who need help. Why do you work on non-humans? And my answer is very simple. That's my choice. There's plenty of really good people who work on human well-being, but they're not separate. They really are very intimately related. And so once again, Roots and Shoots and Compassionate Conservation and the science of animal well-being all kind of merge together by recognizing the importance of all stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. I agree. They really are all interconnected. So in our last few minutes here, Mark, do you mind sharing with our listeners in your own words why humane education is important?
Oh, yeah. You can just sit back for an hour and I'll tell you. No, I mean, it's actually, you know, it's one of these things. Mark Twain once said to a friend, I'm sorry for the long letter. I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. And so I love that. And so when I was doing this answer, I was thinking of Mark Twain's thinking, I could talk for an hour, but I'll tell you why I think humane education is important. And the simple thing is we want to imprint people of all ages, all cultures on compassion, empathy, respect for other animals, including human animals. And the best way to do it is to talk about humane principles, to get killing off the table, to get harming other animals and humans off the table, to get out of that paradigm of thinking that, well, I'm doing the best I can, and I'm sorry if other animals, including non-human animals and human animals, suffer, but I'm doing the best I can. And my take is that the best you can means that you just stop intentionally harming and killing other beings, sentient or not. So to me, people will say, well, what about these animals who, you know, who don't have feelings? And, you know, I just go, well, number one, we don't know if they have feelings. And number two, it doesn't matter, they're alive. That's my take. And some people might think it's radical. And, you know, some people might, I've been told it's untenable. But I think if we don't put ideas out there for discussion, they'll never get discussed and they'll never be implemented. And so I always use the phrase humane education and inhumane education, like what's happening in New Zealand now in their brutal war on wildlife to get rid of all predators by the year 2050. They're having school-sanctioned events where kids are taught to kill animals. That's a form of inhumane education.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So the importance is really to get people to think positively about other life forms and to think positively about the life and the well-being of each and every individual.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Thank you again, Mark, for joining us on Connected Roots. We really appreciate your time, and I look forward to future opportunities to connect and learn together.
Well, thank you. This is great. Like I said, when I learned about your coalition, you know, sometime during the past year, I was thrilled to see something, you know, with the phrase humane education in it. I do a lot of work with Zoe Weil and the Institute for Humane Education. And I think the more we can get the phrase humane education out there, the better it will be. And so it's my pleasure, Megan, to work with you and to do whatever I can to help you all along.
Learn more about Mark and all his books at markbeckoff.com. Also check out the Roots and Shoots program at rootsandshoots.org. This concludes our episode of Connected Roots. Thanks for tuning in. You can visit or subscribe to our podcast at hecoalition.org/podcast for news, heartfelt stories, educational experiences, and moments of kindness from changemakers around the world. Please also consider sponsoring our podcast. Your sponsorship allows us to continue this educational program for our global network of listeners who rely on the resources we share. Visit hecoalition.org/give for details. Thanks again for listening to Connected Roots, and thank you for all you do to create a more compassionate, just, and sustainable world.